Or enough he did. Changed his name, of course. They all do. I understand. First time I saw him on the screen, I recognized him right away. I got kind of excited, you know? Just think, I used to serve free coffee to Nick Tremaine.
Irene caught her breath. You're sure Nick Tremaine's real name is Archie Guthrie?
Oh, yeah. Saw him in Sea of Shadows and then in Fortune's Rogue. No mistaking him.
I understand he left town with one of the other young actresses who got coffee at your cafe.
Yep. There were four of them. Two young men and two young women. One of the men died in a fire at a local studio. The filmmaker died in that fire, too. As for Betty, the actress who worked for me, she was killed in a tragic accident. Slipped and fell in the bathtub. Real sad. The other two went to Hollywood.
What happened to the woman who ran off to California with Nick Tremaine?
I don't know. Doubt if she'll ever make it to the silver screen, though.
Why not?
She didn't have that special something.
Can you describe her?
Tall, dark hair, pretty girl, but I don't think she had much talent. She had a job in an office, as I recall. A secretary, I think. Probably should have stuck with it. I'm sure she's no longer with Archie. I mean, Nick Tremaine.
Why not?
I read all the Hollywood magazines. According to them, Tremaine has a new girl on his arm every other week.
Thank you, Irene said. Very gently, she put down the receiver. For a long moment, she simply stared, appalled at the note she had made during the two conversations. Shocked understanding lanced through her. It was followed by a rush of guilt. I've been wrong from the start. Chapter 60. Henry Oakes paused in the shady gardens just outside Oliver Ward's private villa. He had been doing a lot of thinking and had decided that he could not wait any longer. He was Nick Tremaine's special friend, after all. He had to do whatever was necessary to protect his pal. Someday Nick would understand and thank him. It had been easy enough gaining access to the hotel grounds. He had crawled into the back of a delivery truck, bringing crates of fresh vegetables to the hotel kitchen. There had been a guard at the gate, but he recognized the driver and waved him through. Henry had jumped out of the truck at the first opportunity. The driver never knew that he had a passenger. Once on the hotel grounds, Henry had made his way into the extensive gardens. He was dressed like a maintenance man in overalls and boots. He had a cap pulled down low over his eyes. He kept his head down and walked purposefully toward his goal. He had learned long ago that no one ever paid any attention to a working man who looked like he knew where he was going. He stood in the shade and watched the front door of the villa. No one else had appeared after Ward left. The woman who was causing trouble for Nick Tremaine was inside. She was still hanging around the hotel, still trying to find a way to hurt Nick Tremaine. One of the hotel security guards was watching the front door of the villa. Henry took the small bottle of chloroform out of his pocket. He had warned Irene Glasson. Chapter 61. She went painstakingly back through her notes. She had to be sure this time she could not risk another mistake. She updated the timeline, rearranged a few details, and walked through the logic again. In the end, it all went back to Seattle, Irene thought. The answers were there at the beginning. The destruction of the films made by the small Seattle movie studio, the death of the filmmaker and one of the actors, the drowning of Betty Scott. There had been four of them at the start. Two were now deceased. Nick had become a star. The only one missing from the timeline was the other young actress who had run off to Hollywood with Nick. For all intents and purposes, she had vanished. Except that she hadn't. Irene picked up the phone again and dialed the number of Oliver's office. Elena answered.
Elena, this is Irene. Is Oliver there?
I'm afraid not, Elena said. He's with Chester in the workshop. They're testing a new alarm system, I believe.
I know where the workshop is. I'll find him. Mr. Ward said that you weren't to leave Casa del Mar without one of the security guards,
Elena said quickly.
Don't worry, there's a guard out front. He can accompany me.
All right. Irene replaced the receiver, grabbed her handbag, and rushed to the door. Henry Oakes was on the front step. He was dressed in workman's clothes, complete with a tool belt. There was a knife in the belt. He fixed her with his disturbing gaze.
I'm sorry, Miss Glasson, he said.
Irene tried to slam the door shut, but Henry had one foot over the threshold.
Wait, he said. You have to let me in.
Get away from me, Irene said. You're crazy.
No, Henry blurted. You gotta let me explain. I got confused.
Claudia Picton appeared, moving away from the side of the house where she had been concealed. She had a gun in one hand and a length of iron that looked a lot like a crowbar in the other.
Yes, I'm afraid he's very confused, she said. Nuts, actually. Inside, both of you.
Irene retreated a few steps. Henry stumbled awkwardly into the foyer. He looked bewildered. Claudia followed him into the villa and closed the door. Henry gave Irene a pleading look.
I tried to warn you. I told you not to bother Mr. Tremaine.
Where's the guard? Irene said. What did you do to him? Nothing, Claudia smiled. Henry took care of him for me, didn't you, Henry?
I put him in the gardening shed, Henry said.
He looked and sounded utterly bewildered.
I had to get him out of the way. I needed to talk to you, but I didn't understand.
You're right, Henry, Claudia said. You don't understand at all.
In a lightning move, Claudia raised her hand and slammed the butt of the gun against the back of Henry's skull. He dropped to his knees, grunting. Blood leaked from his head. Claudia struck him again. This time he collapsed face down. Irene looked at Claudia.
You've had a lot of practice doing that, haven't you?
Yes.
Rage glinted in Claudia's eyes.
Yes. I've had some practice, and I'm going to get some more today. I knew you were going to be a problem for my star, she said.
Chapter 62. If you pull that trigger, someone will hear the shot, Irene said.
I doubt it, Claudia said.
She stepped over Henry's unmoving body.
This villa is quite secluded. Everyone knows that Oliver Ward likes his privacy. Even if someone did hear a shot, it would probably be dismissed as a backfire. No one expects to hear gunshots in a classy place like the Burning Cove Hotel. But I didn't come here to kill you, Irene.
For some reason, I don't believe you. I'm afraid you're a rather poor actress, Claudia.
You think you know everything, don't you? I just want to talk to you. Turn around. Let's go into the living room. We're going to have a chat like two normal people.
Irene did not move.
As far as I can tell, there's not much normal about you, Claudia. Lucky for you, Henry Oakes came along, right? What would you have done with the guard at the front door?
He wouldn't have been a problem. I would have handled him the same way I did Henry Oakes.
Out of nowhere, Irene remembered the advice that Oliver had given to the car full of young people who came across them at the secluded beach. Never turn your back on the ocean. It will take you by surprise every time. Claudia was like the wild surf at the foot of the cliffs, she thought, filled with treacherous currents. Her victims had all been struck from behind. Perhaps she had a problem with looking them in the eye. Or maybe she simply couldn't come up with another way to commit murder. According to Oliver, most tricks were simple enough. The hard part was figuring out a new way to create the same illusion. Cautiously, Irene retreated backward into the living room, never turning her back to Claudia.
I said turn around, Claudia said.
We both know I can't do that, Irene said, gentling her tone. Not until you tell me what you came here to say. You want me to know your side of the story, don't you? She halted next to Oliver's big, thickly cushioned reading chair, vaguely surprised to realize that she was still clutching her handbag. Claudia stopped at the edge of the living room, several feet away.
You've got it all wrong, she said. I came here to explain things, before anyone else gets hurt.
I see. How many people exactly have been hurt so far? Seething anger flashed in Claudia's eyes, burning away all traces of nervy anxiety. She drew visible strength from the maelstrom.
I didn't have any choice, she said.
Oliver had also mentioned the virtues of misdirection, Irene thought. She had to find a way to keep Claudia talking.
I assume that not all the films you and your friends made in Seattle were destroyed in the fire at that little movie studio, she said. Betty told us that they were all gone, but she lied. She saved the two that Nick made, Island Nights and Pirates Captive.
Who burned down the studio?
That was Betty. She was in love with Nick, you see. He was plain Archie Guthrie in those days, but after he told her that he was going to Hollywood with me, she was furious. She knew that if Archie made it big, those films would make excellent blackmail material.
She murdered the man who made those films and the other actor?
I honestly don't know if she intended that creepy director and Ralph to die in the fire, but they were both there that night, probably passed out. They were heroin addicts.
When did you learn that Betty had stolen the two pornographic films? Irene asked.
She made her demands right after the release of Nick's first film, Sea of Shadows. She telephoned him anonymously and told him how much she wanted. Nick panicked. He planned to go straight to Ernie Ogden, but I knew that would be a disaster. Nick was clearly an up-and-coming actor, but he wasn't a real star, not yet. I was sure the studio would drop him rather than pay blackmail, so I told Nick that I would take care of everything.
He believed you?
Of course, Claudia smiled. He needs me, and he knows it. I'm the one who slept with three different directors in order to get him his first screen test. I'm the one who came up with the name Nick Tremaine. I'm the one who read his lines with him. I'm the one who worked the lunch counter at Woolworth's and picked up traveling businessmen in bars in order to pay the rent. I did it so that Nick could focus on his acting.
How did you land the job as his personal assistant?
It was obvious after the release of Sea of Shadows that women loved Nick Tremaine. The studio publicist wanted Nick to get single in a hurry. Better for his image, they said. They told him that he had to get divorced.
The penny dropped. You and Nick Tremaine were married? Irene asked.
Is that so hard to believe?
No, Irene said. No, it's all starting to make a lot more sense.
The studio said they would pay for me to spend 6 weeks in Reno at a divorce ranch. For a pitiful amount of money, I was supposed to disappear.
They paid you to get the divorce?
Not nearly enough to make up for what I would lose in the long run. Not enough to compensate me for the sacrifices I had made. I knew that unless Nick made some huge mistake, in a few years he would be worth millions. As his wife, I would have gotten a share of the money.
But as his ex, you'd wind up with nothing.
It wasn't fair, Claudia said. Nick pleaded with me to get the divorce. They were threatening to cancel his contract if I didn't. I finally told him that I would get the divorce, but in exchange, he had to find a way to let me stay close to him. I reminded him that I was his best friend. I told him that now he was becoming famous, the only person he could ever really trust was someone who had been his friend and his lover from the old days.
He loved you? Claudia snorted.
Archie has never loved anyone but himself. But he knew that he owed me, so he convinced the studio to hire me as his personal assistant. They agreed. All they cared about was that Nick Tremaine was single.
So you went to Reno, got the divorce, changed your name, and became Nick Tremaine's personal assistant.
Just another Hollywood story, Claudia said. But then the blackmail started.
How did you figure out that Betty Scott was the extortionist?
That wasn't hard. By then, the director and Ralph were both dead. There was no one else who would have had access to those two films. It was obvious that Betty was the one who had possession of Island Knights and Pirates Captive.
So you decided to get rid of Betty Scott.
I told her that I would bring the money to her. I took the train to Seattle. We arranged to meet at the boarding house on a night when everyone else was out partying. I went upstairs to her room. She came out into the hall. When she realized I hadn't brought the cash with me, she was furious. I tried to reason with her. I told her that we could both make a lot of money if we just waited until Nick was a bigger star. She laughed in my face. She said that she'd rather have a bird in the hand.
That's when you killed her.
The bitch called me a failed actress.
Claudia's voice rose in fury.
When she turned around to go into her room, I grabbed the big flower vase off a table and I hit her.
Betty Scott was found in the bathtub.
It wasn't easy getting her into the tub, believe me.
What about the films?
Afterward, I searched her room and found the two cans of film.
Claudia got herself back under control.
I now possess the negatives of each of Nick Tremaine's pornographic films. They're dynamite, because they both feature Nick Tremaine having sex with Ralph.
That would be guaranteed to kill Tremaine's career.
Definitely, Claudia said, but timing is everything. A year from now, when Nick is the next Clark Gable, those old films will be worth a fortune. The studio will pay whatever it takes to get a hold of the negatives.
Irene managed to get her handbag open behind the chair. She reached inside, her fingers closed around the small gun. Blackmailing a major film studio will be a very dangerous proposition, she said.
Don't you think I know that? Claudia said. I plan to disappear before I go into business.
Does Archie, Nick Tremaine, believe that Betty's death was an accident?
He did at the time. He wanted to believe it, you see. But now I think he's starting to wonder. Sometimes he looks at me as if he's no longer sure he can trust me. That other reporter from Whispers is the one who put the doubts in his mind.
You murdered Peggy Hackett because she was closing in on the story about the pornographic films, didn't you?
I had to get rid of her. I broke into her house and waited for her upstairs in a hall closet. I couldn't believe my luck when she had a couple of martinis and then decided to take a bath.
The fireplace poker was missing. That's what you used to kill her.
She heard me at the very last instant, but by then it was too late.
Why did you murder Gloria Maitland?
She got too close to Nick, Claudia said. They had an affair. He got drunk and made the mistake of telling her about those early films. After he dumped her, she started hounding him. Ogden paid her to go away, but she didn't.
Why did she follow Nick to Burning Cove?
She told Nick she would give him one last chance to resume their affair. They quarreled.
That was the fight that the hotel housekeeper witnessed.
Nick has a temper. He lost it and told Gloria that he never wanted to see her again.
I kept an eye on her.
No one ever notices the star's personal assistant. The next night, she spent the evening drinking alone in the lounge. That wasn't like her. Gloria liked to have people around. When she left, I followed her. When she went into the spa, I knew something was up. I confronted her. She laughed at me, told me that you would be there any minute. She said that if I came up with more money than Whispers, she'd keep quiet.
What did you use to hit her?
A rock from the garden, Claudia said.
You shoved her into the water to drown, and then you tried to murder me.
I didn't know how much you knew at that point or what you'd seen. I couldn't think of anything else to do. When you escaped, I got scared. The next morning, the story of Gloria Maitland's drowning was on the front page of Whispers, and you had implicated Archie. Ogden called, demanding to know what was going on.
You knew you had lost control of the situation. Ernie Ogden took over. He sent someone to search my apartment. He got me evicted. He even got me fired.
That should have been enough to silence you, but you didn't go away, Claudia said. Ogden said there was no need to worry, but I knew he was wrong.
So you cooked up the scheme to make me disappear in a fire. Was Ogden in on that plan?
No. He had no way of knowing how high the stakes were, you see. He thought that with you off the Gloria Maitland story, everything was under control. But I knew you weren't going to stop.
You were afraid that eventually I'd make the connections between the murders and those two early pornographic films. You used poor Daisy Jennings to lure me to that warehouse. You killed her. If Ernie Ogden wasn't involved, how did you arrange to send Springer and Dallas to set the fire?
It's no secret at the studio that Ogden uses Hollywood Mac when he wants some muscle work done. I made the call to Mac, told him that Mr. Ogden wanted Springer and Dallas to throw a real scare into a nosy reporter. I told him I knew exactly where you would be that night, and that Mr. Ogden wanted the warehouse set on fire.
But you weren't going to take any chances, were you? Irene said. You were going to make sure I was dead first.
I waited for you in the old boathouse, but everything went wrong.
Because Oliver Ward showed up first, and you knew that he was probably armed.
I realized that if he had accompanied you, he suspected a trap, so I stayed out of sight and waited for Springer and Dallas to arrive. I hoped that I'd get lucky, and that you and Ward would both die in the fire.
But that didn't happen.
Things kept going wrong!
Claudia's voice climbed in an unstable wail of frustration and rage.
Let me see if I've got this straight, Irene said. You murdered Betty Scott at the start, and then you killed three more people to cover up your crime. I think that's all I need to write my story. You're going to make headlines in the morning, Claudia Picton. Congratulations.
Shut up!
Claudia made a jerky motion with the gun.
Outside! Move!
Irene glanced at the crowbar in Claudia's hand.
Are you planning to bash me over the head and dump me in the lap pool? You've got to be kidding me. How will you explain poor Henry Oak's death?
Claudia smiled.
You've got it all wrong. Again, everyone will think this is Henry Oak's gun. They'll assume that he's the one who shot you, and then he will put the gun to his own head. It will turn out that all the murders were committed by a crazed fan.
You're finally going to rewrite the murder scene.
This is the last scene. It needs to be different.
Irene looked past Claudia toward the front door.
Heard enough, detective.
Claudia did not bother to glance over her shoulder.
You think I'm dumb enough to fall for that trick? She asked.
It was worth a try.
Move!
So you can shoot me in the back? You really have an issue with doing this sort of thing face to face, don't you?
I said turn around. Outside, now.
I get it. You're planning to shoot me, but you still want to finish me off in the pool.
Tell me, why do you like to use water? Was it because that was how you staged the first murder, or does it have some other significance? Turn around, damn you!
Claudia was shaking with rage now. The gun wobbled. Irene obediently started to turn, as though she was about to walk out onto the patio. She yanked Helen's gun out of her handbag and dropped to the floor behind the chair.
Get up!
Claudia screeched. Irene leaped around the side of the chair, revealing the gun in her hand.
Get out of this house, she said. Run while you can.
The sight of the weapon seemed to transfix Claudia. She stared at it, horrified.
Drop it or I swear I'll shoot, Irene said, keeping the heavy chair between herself and Claudia. You'll probably get a shot off, but it will most likely hit the chair. I can't miss, not at this range.
No, Claudia whispered. No, damn you.
She reeled backward, simultaneously squeezing the trigger. Her gun roared. The sound was deafening, but Irene realized in a rather vague way that she wasn't dead. The bullet had plowed into the heavily padded back of the chair. Evidently, Claudia hadn't had much experience with guns, either. Irene leaned around the chair again and pulled the trigger of Helen's gun, not bothering to aim, just trying to scare the daylights out of Claudia. There was an audible click. Nothing happened. jammed, she thought, or something. She didn't know enough about guns to even begin to guess what had gone wrong. A fine time for Oliver to be proved right about the unreliability of firearms. She had nothing left to lose now. Damned if she would stay where she was, cowering behind the reading chair while she waited for Claudia to put a bullet in her head. She would rather go down fighting. She leaped to her feet and hurled the useless gun at Claudia, who instinctively ducked and retreated again. This time she stumbled against Henry Oak's inert body. She nearly lost her balance. Irene grabbed the fireplace poker out of the iron stand, jumped to her feet, and charged. It was the last thing Claudia was expecting. Confused and disoriented, she stumbled again and looked down, trying to find a way to get past Henry Oak's body. She seemed transfixed by the sight of the madwoman closing in on her with the heavy poker. Maybe she was recalling the occasions when she had used a similarly lethal object to knock her victims unconscious before drowning them. Maybe she was simply panicked. Whatever the case, she scrambled backward and came up hard against the liquor cabinet. She squeezed the trigger convulsively, but she was too panic-stricken to even try to aim. Her gun roared again, but the bullet ploughed into the ceiling. Irene held the poker like a sword and drove straight for Claudia's midsection. Claudia reeled to the side in a desperate effort to avoid the poker. She stumbled and went down. The gun fell from her hand. Irene turned aside long enough to kick the weapon across the tiled floor, out of Claudia's reach. Gripping the poker in both hands, she stood over Claudia. "Move, and I'll smash your head just like you crushed Peggy's head," Irene said. Crouched on the floor, Claudia stared up at her. "You're crazy." "Right now? Definitely." The front door slammed open. "Nobody moves!" Oliver thundered in a voice that had once electrified audiences. Irene and Claudia went utterly still for a beat. Then they both looked at Oliver. He had a gun in his hand. "You can put that poker down now, Irene," he said. She took a couple steps away from Claudia. She was breathing hard.
"She murdered Peggy," she said. "She killed all of them."
"I understand," Oliver said, "but she won't kill again. You can put the poker down." Irene focused on the poker. She realized she still had a death grip on it. She took another deep breath.
"All right," she said.
She set the poker down with great care.
"The guard, I think Henry Oakes did something to him. Oakes said something about the gardening shed."
Another guard showed up at the door. He was red-faced from running. He looked at Oliver for direction.
"Find Randy Seaton," Oliver said. "He may be hurt. Search the gardening shed first."
"Yes, sir."
The guard raced off. Irene went to Henry Oakes. She put two fingers to his throat and nearly collapsed with relief when she found a pulse.
"He's alive," she whispered.
"Get the gun, Chester," Oliver said quietly when his uncle appeared behind him. "Use a handkerchief. There will be fingerprints."
"Don't you think I know that?" Chester muttered.
He whipped a handkerchief out of his overalls and moved to scoop up the weapon. Another voice spoke from the front doorway.
"What's going on here?" Nick Tremaine said.
He took two steps into the room and stopped short.
"Claudia, what have you done?"
Oliver looked at him.
"The more interesting question at the moment is, what are you doing here?"
Nick switched his attention to Irene. He looked stunned. Probably sees his career going up in flames, she thought.
"I couldn't find her," he explained in a dull, defeated voice. "No one seemed to know where she was. That's not like her. She usually sticks to her routine. I went to the front desk and asked if they had seen her. They said no. But the hotel operator said that Claudia had recently taken a telephone call from Seattle. That didn't make sense. I got a bad feeling."
"So you came here," Oliver said.
Nick groaned.
"Yeah. I was afraid she might have decided to confront Miss Glasson, maybe do something terrible."
The red-faced guard reappeared in the doorway. He was panting now.
"Found Randy," he gasped. He's tied up in the shed, but he's not hurt. Kind of sick, though. Says a workman showed up saying he had been sent to fix a plumbing problem. Randy was suspicious. He started to turn around and knock on the door to see if anyone had called a plumber. And that's the last thing he remembers.
Go take care of him, Oliver said.
No!
Claudia shrieked. She scrambled to her feet.
It doesn't end this way. Not after all I've done.
You're wrong, Irene said. It does end this way, and it ends now. Claudia burst into tears. She turned to Nick, pleading now.
You need me, Archie. We're a team. The studio knows that. The studio will protect me.
No, Oliver said. The studio won't protect you. You're not the star. You're just Nick Tremaine's personal assistant. You can be replaced. Claudia succumbed to another round of tears. No one offered comfort. Oliver looked at Irene. His usually unreadable eyes were intense with some fierce emotion.
Are you sure you're all right? He asked.
No, she said. But I will be just as soon as I get to a typewriter.
Chapter 63. Irene walked into the offices of the Burning Cove Herald and stopped at the front desk. The sign read, Trish Harrison, Society News.
I'd like to speak with the editor, Irene said.
The 40-something woman behind the desk stopped typing long enough to take the cigarette out of the corner of her mouth.
Who are...
she began in a smoky voice. She stopped and no longer looked bored.
Hell, you're Oliver Ward's new girlfriend, aren't you? I recognize you. Your picture was in Silver Screen Secrets.
Will you direct me to your editor's office, or shall I just start opening doors?
Trish gave her a hard look.
I'm the society reporter. If you've got any news from the Burning Cove Hotel, I'm the one you should talk to.
Sorry, Irene said. I'm out of the gossip business.
In that case, Paisley's office is down there, Trish said.
She waved a hand toward an office at the back of the room, stuck the cigarette back in her mouth, and returned to her typing. Irene made her way past a few more desks. The typewriters went silent. Everyone in the room was watching her now. She ignored the stares and rapped smartly on the door marked Edwin Paisley, Editor-in-Chief.
Doors open!
Irene opened the door, marched into the room, and closed the door very firmly. The room reeked of cigar smoke. She went straight to the window and opened it. Edwin Paisley was balding, middle-aged, and portly. He looked like the washed-up journalist he no doubt was. Maybe at one time he had dreamed of becoming a crack reporter, Irene thought. But somewhere along the line he had given up on his ambitions. He had probably spent too many years putting out a small local paper that focused on garden parties, diet fads, society luncheons, and discreet hints about various stars who had been seen arriving or departing from Burning Cove Hotel.
"Who the hell?"
he began. He stopped and squinted at her over the top of the glasses perched on his nose.
"Wait, I recognize you. You're Ward's new girlfriend."
I'm Irene Glasson, a reporter. I'm here to apply for a position on your staff.
No job openings, Edwin said. He scowled. Tell Ward, if he wants me to hire you, he'll have to come up with the money for your salary. He'll also need to supply a desk and an office and a typewriter.
You'd hire me if Oliver Ward insisted on it?
He owns the Burning Cove Hotel, and Luther Pell is his best friend. Between them, those two control a big chunk of this town. I'm just the editor of the local paper, not like I'm William Randolph Hearst. So yeah, if Ward applies pressure to hire you, I'll do it.
But you won't like it.
Would you?
Irene smiled.
Relax, you've got nothing to worry about. Mr. Ward is not going to push you to hire me. In fact, I think he's rather hoping that you won't.
That's supposed to reassure me? Look, I don't need another reporter on the local society beat, which is about the only beat this paper covers— Unless you count births and obituaries.
I'm well aware of the narrow focus of the reportage one finds in the Burning Cove Herald.
Edwin snorted. Reportage?
Never mind. She planted her handbag on his desk. What you need is a good crime beat reporter. That's the job I want. Edwin stared at her as if she'd turned a peculiar shade of purple.
We don't get much crime in Burning Cove. At least we didn't until you arrived in town. I'll admit, things have gotten a little more exciting lately.
Good news, Mr. Paisley. I've decided to stick around.
I am, of course, overjoyed that you have chosen to settle down here in our little corner of paradise, but I'm not giving you a job unless Ward threatens to break my arm or make me disappear. Sometimes I forget he was a magician.
Don't worry. I'll make sure Oliver doesn't apply any pressure. And I'm not asking you to give me a job, by the way. I'm going to earn it, starting with my first story.
Irene opened her handbag and took out the pages she had typed that morning on Elena's typewriter. Edwin eyed the pages.
What's this?
The story that'll be all over the front pages of the L.A. Press tomorrow. It will be in one of the Seattle papers, too. I made some promises. But it's yours to break tonight.
She handed him the first page.
Who's Claudia Picton?
A crazed killer who murdered 4 women, including Daisy Jennings, a local resident. What's more, Picton would have kept right on killing if not for the heroic actions of Nick Tremaine.
Tremaine? The actor?
Right. Turns out he plays heroes not only on the silver screen, but in real life, too. Miss Picton is now in custody at the Burning Cove police station. The cops expect an insanity plea.
You've got a story featuring Nick Tremaine and a deranged female killer? Why aren't you taking this to your paper, Whispers?
Because I was fired.
Oh, yeah. Heard about that.
Don't worry. Whispers will have the story along with every other paper in L.A. for their morning editions. Nick Tremaine's studio will make sure of it, but I'm offering you an exclusive today. You can run with it in your evening edition tonight.
We don't have an evening edition.
Make it a special edition. All I ask is that I get a byline.
And a job.
Read the story, Mr. Paisley. She put the typewritten pages on the desk. I've got quotes from Nick Tremaine himself, not to mention Oliver Ward and Luther Pell.
Ward and Pell never grant interviews.
They made an exception for me. Go ahead, read the story, and then tell me you'll print it.
Chapter 64.
Why aren't I dead? Irene asked. Claudia had a gun. She got off 2 shots. I should be dead. The 4 of them were on the patio of Oliver's villa. Oliver, Chester, Luther, and herself. Oliver kept casting worried glances in her direction, so she did her best to look like the cool-headed journalist who had just concluded a successful investigation. It was Luther who answered her question. His eyes were bleak with a dark knowledge, and there was an oddly remote quality in his voice.
It's true that Picton had a gun, but it's surprisingly difficult to hit someone who's charging straight at you, he said, especially when your attacker is armed with a lethal weapon like a poker. In addition to the problem of aiming at a moving target, there is the added psychological factor. Your first instinct is to dodge the sharp object that is aimed at you.
Irene looked at him. They all did. No one commented, but she knew they were all thinking the same thing. Luther was not speaking theoretically. He was remembering scenes from nightmares. He wasn't thinking about pokers. He was thinking about fixed bayonets. It was Oliver who broke the short silence that followed the observation.
Luther's right, he said. By charging Picton with that poker, you took an enormous risk, but you also presented the ultimate distraction. She panicked.
What made you realize that Claudia had come after me? Irene said. Her nerves were still on edge, and she knew that she would not sleep well that night. She might not sleep well for a long time to come. She would never be able to forget the feral expression in Claudia's eyes.
I didn't, Oliver said. Not until I opened the door and saw you standing over Claudia with that poker in your hand. The reason I went back to the villa was because someone in housekeeping spotted an unknown workman matching Oak's description on the grounds.
Irene smiled. You did say housekeeping was the front line of security here at the hotel. No one pays any attention to the maids. Luther leaned back in his chair. He contemplated Irene.
Any idea what it was that made Claudia Picton choose today to attack you? She must have been desperate to take such a risk right here on the grounds of the hotel.
She felt she had to act, Irene said. She had just gotten a warning, you see. I made some telephone calls to Seattle this morning. One of them was to Phyllis Kemp, the landlady in Seattle. Peggy Hackett made the same phone call. I'm sure it was that call that led to her murder. Calling Kemp almost got me killed today. It was the second time I'd called, you see.
Chester's brows scrunched together.
Kemp called Claudia Picton and told her that you had just telephoned asking about Betty Scott.
Yes, the news clearly terrified Claudia, Irene said. She panicked because she knew I was closing in on the story. She probably assumed the odds were very good that Oliver wouldn't be home during the day. He's an executive, after all. He was likely to be in his office. She took a chance and came to the villa, hoping to find me alone. She ran into Henry Oakes, who was watching me, because he believed I was a threat to Nick Tremaine.
So much for my ability to read a member of the audience, Oliver said. I knew Claudia Picton was a nervous, over-anxious woman. I assumed that she wanted to protect her job, but I've got to admit, it never occurred to me she would risk her life or a murder rap to do so.
Chester shook his head.
It was the money! Reckon all Picton could see were the millions of dollars that she would someday collect.
No, it wasn't just the money, Irene said. She wanted revenge. I think she believed that she had sacrificed her own dreams for the sake of Nick Tremaine's career. You read her correctly, Oliver, but you didn't have all the facts. None of us did. We didn't know that Claudia had once been married to Nick Tremaine, and that she had been paid to get a quickie divorce.
That fact changes everything. Oliver said quietly. It makes it all personal.
Yes, Luther said. He looked thoughtful. It does.
Oliver's eyes tightened a little.
There's only one reason why the landlady, Phyllis Kemp, would have made that phone call to Picton today. She must have been involved in Picton's blackmail scheme.
She was.
Detective Brandon spoke from the living room doorway. He walked out onto the patio. He looked at Oliver.
The housekeeper guarding your front door let me in. Hope that's all right.
Mrs. Taylor is there to make sure no members of the press sneak into the front garden, Oliver said.
Irene raised her brows. Except me, of course. Brandon chuckled and lowered himself into a chair. He looked tired but satisfied.
Phyllis Kemp is now talking to the Seattle police, he said. Turns out she's Claudia Picton's aunt. Picton's only close relation. Kemp is maintaining her innocence, but Picton says she was in on the scheme from the beginning. It was Kemp who made certain that Betty Scott was alone in the boarding house the night Picton confronted her about the blackmail threat. In fact, according to Picton, Phyllis Kemp helped her stage the bathtub scene.
When I called Mrs. Kemp again and asked more questions, she realized that yet another Hollywood reporter was closing in on the truth. She hung up and immediately called Claudia.
Who panicked? Oliver said. She grabbed a gun and a crowbar from the trunk of her car and went looking for Irene.
So, Tremaine's ex-wife was his personal assistant, Chester said. He snorted. That had to be a strange setup.
Stranger things happen in Hollywood, Luther said.
So tell me, Brandon said. Speaking of Hollywood, the studio cut Claudia Picton loose immediately, as you said they would, Oliver.
I wonder how much Daisy Jennings knew about what was going on, Luther mused.
Very little, Brandon said. From what I can tell, she had a one-time fling with Nick Tremaine in the garden of the Paradise Club. Later, Claudia Picton offered her cash to lure Miss Glasson to the warehouse.
Picton also gave Jennings a script to read that contained two film titles. Jennings must have known something dangerous was happening, Oliver said.
Maybe, Brandon said.
Regardless, it looks like she took the money and didn't ask too many questions.
Chester scowled.
What about that studio executive, Ernie Ogden? How much did he know?
According to Claudia Picton, Ogden didn't know that his star was being blackmailed, so he couldn't have known why women with a connection to Nick Tremaine had a bad habit of turning up dead, Irene said. But he must have been getting concerned. What's more, I think Claudia Picton knew that. It's probably why she was so desperate today. If the studio dumped Tremaine, her blackmail scheme would go down the drain. She'd have committed several murders and have nothing to show for it. I'm sure that situation was an additional source of stress for her.
No wonder she always looked so nervous, Chester said. She's looking a lot more anxious now, Brandon said. She's doing a good job of acting like she's nuts. Got a hunch she's going to go with an insanity plea.
What will happen to Henry Oakes? Irene asked. I think he's a little crazy, but he wasn't a killer.
Brandon grunted. He's going to recover from his head wound. That's the good news. The bad news is that he's still crazy. Thinks he's Nick Tremaine's special friend and that he has to protect the star. I'll have a little chat with him before he leaves the hospital, but if that doesn't work, I guess the studio will have to deal with him. That's what men like Ernie Ogden get paid to do, Luther said. I know, Brandon said. He shook his head. I've seen that kind of crazy before, and there's no cure.
Irene glanced at her watch and got to her feet. It's almost 3 o'clock. If you gentlemen will excuse me, I have an appointment with Nick Tremaine. The men rose. Chester looked surprised.
Tremaine's agreed to another interview?
Not exactly, Irene said. I owe him an apology. He has graciously agreed to accept it. We're having tea together.
Be forewarned, Oliver said. There will be a studio photographer and a publicist present. Ogden sent them here in a chauffeured limo.
In that case, I'll go upstairs and put on some fresh lipstick, Irene said.
Brandon chuckled. I thought the Burning Cove Hotel had a firm policy when it came to photographers and publicists. They aren't allowed on the grounds. It's my hotel, Oliver said. I made the policy. I can make exceptions.
Luther gave him a knowing look.
You kept the lid on a major scandal involving a fast-rising star, and you arranged things so that Tremaine came out of a messy situation looking like a real hero. His studio is going to be very grateful.
I'm counting on it, Oliver said.
Luther smiled.
In other words, casting Tremaine as the hero is good for business. Ernie Ogden owes you a very big favor. Having him in your debt is bound to be useful. On top of that, the gossip columnists will fall all over themselves retelling the story of Tremaine's heroics, and the Burning Cove Hotel will be featured in every single piece that appears in papers across the nation.
Nothing like good publicity, Oliver said.
Brandon got to his feet.
Sounds complicated. I think I'll stick with the detective business. If you'll excuse me, I'm going back to work.
He nodded politely at Irene and disappeared into the living room. A moment later, the door closed quietly behind him. Luther looked at Oliver.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe there is one more reason for making Nick Tremaine the star of your little story. It will dominate the news. No one will pay any attention to a much smaller piece about a certain automobile accident that took the life of another guest of the Burning Cove Hotel.
In the magic business, we call it misdirection, Oliver said.
Chapter 65. Nick Tremaine eyed the elegantly wrapped gift box with a wary expression.
What's inside?
2 cans of film, Irene said. The negatives of those 2 movies that you made in Seattle. They were found in Claudia's hotel room. I can't guarantee that there are no copies floating around somewhere, but I very much doubt it. Claudia seemed quite sure that she was the only one who possessed Island Knights and Pirates captive. I had a hunch she would keep them close at hand. Her whole future was tied to them. Nick looked up, his expression watchful.
You found them?
Yes. There was no need to explain that Oliver was the one who had realized that Claudia's suitcase had a false bottom. She and Nick were sitting in a corner of the tea room, alone at last. The studio photographer had taken several pictures of Nick looking both heroic and modest. The publicist had jotted down several quotes from Irene and the management of the Burning Cove Hotel that verified Nick's timely arrival at the scene of the attempted murder. Both the photographer and the publicist were on their way back to L.A. Nick studied the box as though it contained a cobra. When he turned back to Irene, there was anger and resignation in his eyes.
"How much do you want for them?"
he asked, his voice flat. "Nothing. They're yours. It's the least I can do after dragging your name into a murder case." Nick stared at her in disbelief. In his world, there was a price tag attached to everything. Irene picked up the teapot and filled the two cups. By the time she set the pot down, Nick's expression had transformed into cautious hope. He glanced at the box again and turned back to her.
"You know what's on those films?"
"Claudia told me.
Either film could kill my career."
"If I were you, I'd take them down to the beach and burn them." Nick nodded slowly. He put one hand on the box.
"I'll do that," he said. "I thought she loved me, you know."
"Maybe she did, back at the start."
"Something happened after I made Sea of Shadows and Fortune's Rogue."
Irene smiled. "Something happened, all right. You became a star."
"I shouldn't have pleaded with her to get the divorce. Shouldn't have let the studio pressure her into going to Reno."
"For what it's worth, I doubt that would have made much difference. Being married to you would not have been enough. She wanted what you have. She longed to be a star."
"It probably won't last, you know," Nick said.
"The stardom?
Nothing lasts forever.
My advice is to enjoy it while you can. Meanwhile, be careful how you invest the money."
Nick laughed.
The California sun streaming through the windows caught the handsome angles of his face and gleamed on his dark hair. The atmosphere around the little table was infused with a magnetic energy. Heads turned. A little thrill whispered through Irene. She was having tea with a movie star. Chapter 66. The special evening edition of the Burning Cove Herald hit the newsstands shortly after 5 o'clock that afternoon. Irene was waiting at the front desk of the Burning Cove Hotel when the newsboy arrived. She threw some money at the kid, pounced on a copy, and savored the headline. "Crazed female killer arrested at Burning Cove Hotel. Actor Nick Tremaine a hero," say those at the scene. The byline read, "Irene Glasson." One of the front desk clerks leaned toward her.
"The hotel operator says there's a telephone call for you, Miss Glasson. You can take it on the house phone."
"Thanks." Irene hurried to the ornate telephone that sat on a nearby console. She picked up the receiver.
"This is Irene Glasson."
"First edition is sold out," Edwin Paisley announced. His voice vibrated with excitement. "We're going back to press. I want a follow-up piece for the morning edition. Get me some more quotes from Tremaine. I want stuff that won't be in the L.A. papers. I want exclusive material."
"Does this mean I've got a job?"
Yeah, you got the job. You're my new reporter on the crime beat. Now go write me another hot story."
"I'll get right on it, boss."
Edwin hung up. Irene admired her headline again, and then she hurried down the hall to Oliver's office. Elena was in the process of putting the cover on the typewriter.
"Hi, Irene. I was just about to leave for the day. Congratulations on the front-page story."
"You've seen it?"
Elena chuckled.
"Are you kidding? Mr. Ward gave orders for a copy to be delivered by special courier as soon as it came off the press." "To tell you the truth, I think he was a little nervous. He has this thing about reporters and photographers, you see."
"I've heard that," Irene said.
"Well, that's it for me.
Elena said. I must say it's been a busy day. She headed toward the door. See you tomorrow. Bye, Elena. Irene waited until the outer door closed behind Elena, and then she crossed the room to the door of Oliver's office and opened it.
Good news, she said. I've got a job.
Oliver was lounging back in his chair, his good leg propped on the corner of his desk. He had a copy of the special edition of the Herald in his hands.
Figured you would after this story of a crazed female killer prowling the grounds of the Burning Cove Hotel.
He took his foot off the desk and rose. You made my security look bad, but you did a great job of transforming Nick Tremaine into a real hero.
It's the crazed female killer and the movie star hero that people will love. That's all they'll remember. They won't care about your security.
She went behind the desk and wound her arms around Oliver's neck.
Thanks for the quotes, by the way. I may need another one.
Figures. Tell me about the job.
Meet the new crime reporter for the Herald.
According to the local authorities, we don't have much crime in Burning Cove.
With luck, that will change now that there is an actual reporter on the beat.
For some reason, I do not find that a comforting thought, Oliver said.
Nonsense. There's absolutely nothing to worry about. I'm a professional.
Don't remind me.
The amusement vanished from Oliver's eyes.
So, this means you'll be staying in town?
And just like that, the frothy, sparkling sense of delight and excitement that had made her almost giddy went flat. She went very still.
Yes, she said. I like it here. It's not as though there is any place else that feels like home.
Does Burning Cove feel like home?
I think, she said, choosing her words with care, that under the right circumstances, Burning Cove could definitely feel like home.
Let me be more specific. Do you think that Casa del Mar could feel like home?
The weight of caution descended on her. Her future was hanging in the balance. She had to be certain that she understood exactly what Oliver was offering.
Are you inviting me to move in as a permanent house guest?
If that's what you want.
No, she said, it's not what I want.
His eyes turned bleak.
I see.
Was it what you wanted?
She asked.
No.
His voice hardened with pain.
What I want is for you to move in as my wife. But I figured it was too soon to ask you to marry me.
It's not, she said. He looked startled.
It's not too soon to ask you to marry me?
Not if you love me.
Why in hell would I ask you to marry me if I didn't love you?
I have no idea, but I need to be sure. Because I love you.
Irene. She gave him a tremulous smile. Actually, it's Anna. Anna Harris.
Irene, Anna, call yourself whatever you want. I love you, and I will keep on loving you, whether you move in with me or not.
Joy blossomed deep inside her. A moment ago, she had been feeling giddy with success and the promise of a job that gave her an excuse to stay in Burning Cove. But now, she was beyond delighted. She was thrilled, intoxicated with happiness, lighter than air. She tightened her arms around his neck.
I would like very much to marry you and move in with you on a permanent basis.
He tightened his hold on her.
It will be permanent. Forever.
That sounds very good. Perfect, in fact.
Just one question.
Yes.
Do I call you Anna or Irene?
She smiled.
I found a new life here in California as Irene. I'll stick with her.
Sounds good to me.
Besides, it's the name on my byline.
Oliver laughed. He sounded like the happiest man on earth. He kissed her there in the golden light of a California day, and for the first time since she was 14 years old, she knew she could plan a future filled with love and a family of her own.
Chapter 67. Raina Kirk put the updated files relating to the contract for the murder of Helen Spencer into a large envelope. She wrote the address with a neat hand. She would drop it off at the post office later. She removed the remaining files from a locked cabinet and put them into her briefcase. The files weren't the only items in the case. There was also several $1,000 in cash. She closed the briefcase and locked it. She left it sitting on her desk while she crossed the room to put on her coat and the adorable little felt hat that she had bought the day before. With its upturned brim and high crown trimmed with a jaunty feather, it was currently the height of fashion. The instant she had spotted it in the department store window, she knew it was exactly the hat for her. She glanced at the telegram on her desk. It had been delivered early the previous morning before Graham Enright had arrived at the office. Fortunately, she had been there to receive it. Regret to inform you that Julian Enright died in a car crash in Burning Cove, California. The remains are being held in a local morgue. For details, contact Detective Brandon, Burning Cove Police Department. Condolences. She picked up the telegram and took one last look around the office. All was in order. The plant in the corner had been watered, the desktop was clear, the typewriter was covered. It was an office that any secretary could be proud to call her own. It was time to leave. She crossed the room and opened the door of her employer's inner sanctum. Graham Enright was in the same position he had been in when she last peeked into the office, slumped over his desk. The delicate china cup from which he had taken his last swallow of coffee lay in pieces on the polished oak floor. Graham Enright had been dead since yesterday morning. The body was quite cold. She put the telegram on the desk. Satisfied, she left the inner office, closing the door very quietly as she always did. A well-trained secretary never slammed doors. She pulled on her gloves, picked up the briefcase, her handbag, and the envelope, and let herself out into the hall. With luck, it would be quite some time before Graham Enright's body was discovered. Days, perhaps. The janitors were called in only to clean when authorized to do so by Graham Enright himself, who always supervised the process. When someone eventually did find the corpse, the assumption would be that a grief-stricken Enright had taken his own life after learning of the death of his only son and heir. Anyone who thought to check the secretary's calendar would learn that shortly before his death, Graham, a generous employer, had sent her off for a month-long visit to relatives in Pennsylvania. There were no relatives in Pennsylvania, or anywhere else for that matter, but no one would think to question that tiny, insignificant fact, Raina thought. When you discovered that you were working for a family of contract killers, you learned that details were important. They often made the difference between life and death. She had been planning her departure from the firm for some time, merely waiting for the right moment. The news of Julian Enright's death the day before had prompted her to hand in her notice that same day. She had done so with a cup of coffee laced with cyanide. Graham Enright had died without ever seeing the telegram. He did, however, have a moment to realize that his secretary had poisoned him. She had seen the fury and outraged disbelief in his eyes just before he collapsed. That was Enright for you, she thought. Both of them, father and son, had always assumed that they were smarter and more ruthless than those around them. She took the elevator down to the lobby and went outside. The new car she had purchased with some of the cash from the firm's discretionary fund was parked on a side street. She put the briefcase into the trunk alongside her suitcase and got behind the wheel. She stopped at the post office and hurried inside to mail the envelope containing the Helen Spencer file. It was addressed to the local office of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. There was enough material in the envelope to point the FBI to the agent of a foreign government who had commissioned Enright and Enright to retrieve a certain notebook, no questions asked.
What the FBI chose to do with the information was up to them. Raina walked out of the post office, got back into her sharp new car, and drove away from New York. She had given a great deal of thought to her destination. In the end, she concluded that any town that knew how to deal with the likes of Julian Enright was her kind of town. Burning Cove sounded like the perfect place to start her new life. According to the map, the road to the future started in Chicago. Route 66 would take her all the way to California. Chapter 68. There were two armed guards at the front gate of the compound, but it was 3 o'clock in the morning, so they were working hard to stay awake with coffee and low-voiced discussions of sports and women. The intruder had studied the layout of the Saltwood Laboratory earlier in the day from the cover of a stand of trees. He had determined that the weakest point of entry was the loading dock gate. There was a serious-looking lock, but it presented no problems. He was good with locks. He had brought along a set of wire cutters to deal with the alarm system, but in the end he didn't have to use them. He simply opened the device and unplugged it. He found a side door, picked another lock, disarmed another alarm, and then he was inside the darkened building. He had brought a flashlight with him. The metal shielding around the bulb ensured that the device cast only a very narrow beam. He made his way past several doors marked Authorized Personnel Only. Curious, he opened a couple at random and saw shadow-filled lab rooms crowded with workbenches. An assortment of instruments and mechanical equipment was arrayed on each bench. White lab coats and goggles, designed to protect the eyes, dangled from wall hooks. He continued down the hall and turned the corner into another wing lined with office doors. When he located the one marked Dr. Raymond Perry, Executive Director, he picked the lock and entered the reception area. He went past the secretary's desk and paused to unlock the door of the inner office. Dr. Raymond Perry's office was neat and uncluttered, a row of locked file cabinets lined one wall. He did what he had come to do and made his way back out of the building, relocking the doors and resetting the alarms. At the far end of the compound, the guards were still drinking coffee and chatting. He made his way through the stand of trees. The new speedster was waiting in the dense shadow at the side of the road. He got in on the passenger side. Irene turned the key in the ignition and pulled out onto the empty road. "I take it everything went according to plan," she said. "No problems," Oliver said. "I left the notebook on top of the executive director's desk. He'll see it first thing when he goes into his office in the morning."
"He'll wonder how it got there."
"Sure, but it's in his own and his company's best interests to keep quiet. Besides, there's no way he'll be able to figure out how the notebook reappeared."
Irene smiled. "Magic."
"Magic."
"You weren't gone very long. I thought you would have to spend more time getting through the locks and alarms."
"Saltwood has a government contract, so they've got standard government security. They obviously gave the contract to the lowest bidder."
"Of course. So, now we're free to go on our honeymoon."
"Got any particular destination in mind?"
"I hear Burning Cove is a romantic choice for a honeymoon destination."
"I've heard that too," Oliver said. "It's a long drive back to California, but there's no rush. We can stop at some of the roadside attractions along the way."
"That would be nice." Irene patted the steering wheel affectionately. "The last time I drove across the country, I was in a hurry. I didn't get a chance to do any sightseeing."
"This time will be different."
"Yes, it will," Irene said. "This time, we're going home." The end. This is Louisa Jane Underwood. We hope you have enjoyed this production of The Girl Who Knew Too Much by Amanda Quick. Recorded Books offers a wide selection of bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So look for us at your public library or on download sites online. and thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.